We're going to take a look at terrorism because it's one of those issues, of course, that's dominated the public discourse over the past decade or so, and we tend to focus on it whenever an attack's just occurred. But people do study this, and, of course, governments are always concerned about it, even when it's not at the top of the news agenda. The question to ask now, of course, is whether or not the face of terrorism is changing. And the reason I ask that is because an influential committee of the British Parliament has just produced a report which focuses on a few interesting developments. First, the growth of far right-wing groups in the terrorism landscape. Second, the key role of the internet in promoting violent radicalism. And third, the emergence of lone wolf terrorism, which is something of an interesting development. What are the lessons, of course, for Australia? This is a British report. Is the same trends borne out here? And if so, what do we make of them? How do we respond? To discuss this tonight on our Tuesday panel on RN Drive, I'm joined by Dr. Carl Ungerer, who's the Director of the National Security Program at ASPI, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, and also Lydia Khalil, who's the Director of the Risk Capital Group, also a former counterterrorism advisor to the New York Police Department. Welcome to RN Drive to both of you.
Good evening, Waleed.
Hi, Waleed. Thanks.
I might start with you, Dr. Carl Ungerer. Why not? You win the lottery this time. I'm going to start with the lone wolf terrorism thing, because terrorism, of course, has for a long time been thought of as overwhelmingly a group activity. Do you think that this is a genuine trend that we're spotting, or are we perhaps jumping at shadows here because there have been a few lone wolf terrorists in recent times?
Well, Waleed, we should be asking you these questions. You're the expert on terrorism as well. Maybe we should have a panel of three.
Okay, I'll ask myself.
I don't think there's ever been anything really purely as such as lone wolf terrorism. We've never seen an individual operate completely outside any organisational structure by themselves and commit an act of terrorism. Invariably, there is some network that they are part of. Even though, yes, there are individuals like Faisal Shahzad in 2010 who decided to pack his car full of gas bottles and chemicals and tried to blow up Times Square, he failed, but he was an individual. And many people point to incidences like that as being sort of evidence of this new trend of lone wolf terrorism. I think it's certainly there is a trend towards individualization, and that's very true of the ideological debate that's going on inside international Islamist terrorist groups at the moment, but sort of, you know, coming out of places like Yemen, the argument that individuals should make a bomb on their mum's kitchen table and go and do something. But we're not seeing lone wolves per se.
Lydia, do you agree with that? I mean, I know that in the US there's actually been quite a lot of concern from within law enforcement and intelligence agencies there about the emergence of lone wolf terrorism. Are they perhaps mischaracterizing what's actually going on?
Well, you know, the poster boy for lone wolf terrorism, I think, comes from the United States. And I think that's Major Nidal Hassan, who was involved in the Fort Hood shootings back, I think it was about last year that he did that. And he was an individual who became radicalized through his interactions on the internet. He decided to act alone. He procured weapons on his own, and he basically planned out his own attack. Now,
Was it a terrorist attack, though? Because we've figured out enough about what his motive was there. I know there was a question about whether he was mentally ill or sort of wasn't politically motivated. Has that been resolved?
I think it has. I think if you take a look at the email transcripts that he had back and forth with certain individuals online, the writings that he had done either privately or within the U.S. Army establishment that he worked for, I think it was pretty clear that he was politically motivated. It may have been true that he had some, you know, mental health issues as well, but it was clear that he didn't just go off and do this as a random act of violence. It was politically motivated because he didn't agree with the presence of U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan and perceived that, you know, the U.S. foreign policy was targeting Muslims abroad. So, yeah, I think it was pretty clear that he was politically motivated. But again, his lone act, I don't think would have been possible maybe 10 years ago or even 5 years ago without that network of within the internet that Carl was referring to, I think, earlier.
Is it really the internet then that sparks that? Or, I mean, the other example of lone wolf terrorism, which is often cited, is that of Timothy McVeigh. Now, I guess he did have accomplices, so there isn't a question about the categorisation of that. But nonetheless, you're not talking about a vast organised terrorist network.
No, there's certainly no vast terrorist organised network organized, I think, is the keyword online. But there's no doubt that those who are so inclined can access radical material online. They can read it. They can become influenced by that. They can connect with like-minded individuals. And just the prevalence and ease of accessing this information allows people who are already susceptible to that message to become even more enmeshed in it. And I think that's where the danger lies when you're talking about the internet and radicalization. The internet is a neutral tool, keep in mind. I mean, it's not like if you don't have the inclination or proclivity or even any grievances and you go online and see a jihadist video, you're not going to say, oh, sounds like a great idea, I'm going to go bomb the MCG. No. You have to have some sort of grievance and ideological belief prior to that. But the access that you get via the internet is an important part of many individuals' paths to radicalization in recent years.
Okay, so let's talk about the internet then. Dr. Carl Ongerer, do you think that the internet is creating communities of radicalized politics that perhaps couldn't have existed before?
I think there's absolute evidence for that, Walid. I mean, you look at somewhere like Southeast Asia where we've studied the rise of internet radicalization, and it was only sort of 10 years ago you had a number of factors, one of which you had about 20% of individuals in the region actually having access to the internet. That number's rising very rapidly. It's 30% and higher in most countries now. You have the material of 10 years ago, which basically they used to translate Arabic material into local languages, and it was as much about a sort of propaganda machine as it was about anything else. But the sophistication of the media organizations that are attached to terrorist organizations throughout Southeast Asia now is quite phenomenal. You look at the Al Rama group, for instance, and it is a large media organization. It has its own Facebook site. I was looking at that today, some 50,000 individuals who are friends of that Facebook site. Mm-hmm. It has its own production house. It has its own media crews that will go not just throughout Southeast Asia anymore, but internationally to act as a media organization with a particular political spin on the material that they've got. The internet is rapidly transforming as it moves, particularly into social networking websites and web forums, is rapidly moving from just being, as Lydia said, a site at which individuals can go and see this material through to something that's much more interactive, much more, the ability to use those social networking and web forums to identify, groom, radicalize, and convince individuals to conduct terrorism.
Can you really radicalize at a distance or at a virtual distance, though? Or do you ultimately need some kind of real-world interaction in the final analysis at some stage of the process to inspire somebody to take that final step of violence?
Yeah, there's been very few instances of individuals who have been purely radicalized individually over the internet. Irabi 007 was the name of an individual called Yunus in the UK who was one such individual who was just posting Al-Qaeda web videos around the world and became somewhat famous for that before the police arrested him. There was an individual in Singapore, likewise, who viewed material online and decided to act and wanted to go to Afghanistan and join the jihad there. So we have very few instances of individuals who are just interacting with this material online and then deciding to go and commit acts of terrorism. Invariably, the online networks that they have formed have some sort of physical presence before many of these groups actually decide to go and conduct terrorism.
Lydia, what do you think about an organisation as central and frequently discussed as Al-Qaeda? What's their interaction with the internet, and are they aware of these trends and starting to try to take advantage of them?
Well, before I get to that, I just would like to comment quickly on some of Carl's comments and piggyback on that.
Sure.
I think that while it's true that there have been very few instances of individuals who have successfully carried out attacks, I think we need to separate the process in two phases. So you have the radicalization, which means it gets you to the desire to do something, to act, and then it's the implementation. Now, I think it's actually quite easy to radicalize via the material and the networks that you can develop online and via the internet. However, the implementation is what's lacking, because I think once you remove yourself from real-world training, real-world support networks and procurement networks, your ability to conduct an attack that's as lethal as you would have outside of the group dynamic changes.
So but does that mean you have more people who are trying but perhaps just not very good at it because they don't have the same training? So you're getting more attempts but not necessarily more successful terrorist attacks?
Yeah, they're not as successful as someone who's actually trained in a training camp. They don't have the same support network. They don't have the same it's really that lack of support network that makes these attacks small scale and certainly not as dangerous, although they can be just as lethal and quite as destabilizing to society as maybe a large-scale attack.
Well, that's the thing about a terrorist attack, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't take many people and it only needs to come off once and then it becomes something that makes a difference.
That's exactly right, yeah, which is why it's very much of a concern for law enforcement. I know when I was working in law enforcement back in New York, it was these type of attacks that were of most concern to us because there really is no typical terrorist profile. It's very difficult to pick out these people and identify them as being threats before they actually act because they're so, well, you know, there's no warning signs, for example. Mm. They don't belong to a larger group that you can track. They don't publicize their intentions prior to that. So it's like searching for a needle in a haystack.
Now, I know I interrupted you before you had a chance to answer that question about al-Qaeda, but we might just move the conversation on anyway because we don't want to run out of time before we look at all the factors. And just while we're talking about the internet issue and its role in terrorism, I guess that raises questions of what you do about that. So I'd like to bring someone in the conversation. It's 18 minutes past the hour on RN Drive. So far, the voices you've been hearing belong to Dr. Carl Ungerer, who's the Director of the National Security Program at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, and Lydia Khalil, who's the Director of the Risk Capital Group and also a former counterterrorism advisor to the New York Police Department. We're talking about terrorism today because there's been a UK report released that looks at current trends in terrorism, and one of the things they've looked at is the increasing role of the internet. David Cake is the Chair of Electronic Frontiers Australia. He's not a counterterrorism analyst or anything like that, but he is a computer consultant and a graduate student studying internet governance. We thought we'd bring him in on the conversation to see what, if anything, you can do about all of this. Hi, David.
Hi.
All right, let's assume that the internet plays a significant or an increasing role in the radicalisation process and perhaps even the execution of terrorism. Do you think there's anything we can do to stop that?
Well, to some extent, it's really just a natural thing that the internet is taking an increasingly larger role in human communication. That's going to include the sorts we don't like as well as the sorts we're in favour of.
But the question here is whether or not it makes certain things possible that would not otherwise have been possible. And if so, is there any? Are we helpless in the face of that?
No, it certainly raises extra challenges for law enforcement, but it also gives law enforcement additional tools. So it's really, it will change the way things work, but there's not really much we can do about the phenomenon happening.
So, the most obvious calls would be for things like somehow trying to regulate cyberspace or increase surveillance or something like that. Do you think those sort of suggestions are in any way practical?
Not really. It's very difficult to... when you sort of talk about radicalisation, of course you can... we don't want people to perform actual... who move to operational plans and so on, and that's where law enforcement comes in. But it's about regulation of political speech. It's very difficult to do that in such a way to only regulate, particular political speech we dislike while remaining a free democracy.
Well, we've tried to do that with print, but reasonably successfully. I mean, you can do that reasonably easily. But do you think the online space is just such a different animal that it becomes impracticable?
Oh no, and there's certainly ways we can regulate the online space to an extent, but it is much harder to regulate than print in a lot of ways, and because really it's in some ways closer to regulating what people talk about via the post or something. It's much more the practicalities of it become much more difficult. We also have a lot of tools for support of democratic activists in despotic states are exactly the same sort of activists that will be sort of tools that will be used by radicals to conceal their conversation. So the technical tools are certainly there for radicals to use if they want to use them, and they're going to be very hard to defeat. And in some ways, there are ways in which people like the US State Department actually encourage those tools because they want them to be used by democratic activists in dictatorships.
Right. So it's just a matter of whether it's the good guys or the bad guys using it.
Yeah, it really is. The internet is a neutral tool politically in a lot of ways. It can be used by everybody. That's you know, both its charm and its danger.
Mm. Good to get your insights, David. Appreciate it. That's David Cake, the chair of Electronic Frontiers Australia, which is a computer consultant group, and he's also a graduate student studying internet governance. 21 minutes past the hour, I'm joined by Dr. Carl Ungerer, the director of the National Security Program at ASPI, and Lydia Khalil, the director of the Risk Capital Group, a former counterterrorism advisor also to the New York Police Department. I might get both of you now to take a look at the other issue that was raised in the report by the UK government, the UK Parliament, and that is the emergence of far-right-wing terrorism. Is this something that we're only noticing now, that it's sort of September 11th receding more into history, or is there a genuine uptick that we're observing here, Lydia?
I think it's a genuine uptick that we're observing, and I think that if you'd been looking at this issue closely, it's something that's been growing over the past couple of years. Again, I think last year I was struck by this growth of right-wing terrorist groups, but not only its growth, but the ability of Western governments to ignore it. So, for example, in the United States, in about 2010, you had an individual ramming a small plane into the IRS office in Arizona. Now, no one ever said or identified that as a terrorist act, even though
Joseph
he had written
Stack, I think it was, wasn't he? I just remember he had a name that was quite ironic, given he was flying a plane into a building.
That's right, So, and that's exactly right. That was his name, and he wrote a political manifesto saying why he did that, because he was anti-government and, you know, all these things. And instead of politicians condemning it as an act of terrorism for what it was, or a violent act against the government, you had people joking that, oh, well, it's around tax time and, you know, everyone would love to bomb an IRS building because no one wants to pay taxes. I thought that was the response of government to right-wing terrorism was so disturbing, more so than the fact that we were starting to see an uptick of right-wing terrorist acts.
And that, of course, was right in the middle of the Tea Party's emergence. And so that anti-tax rhetoric was very strong in American politics at that time. Carl Ungerer, of course, the big one that captured a lot of people's attention were the attacks in Oslo. Last year, in the middle of last year. Do you think this is a European or American problem rather than an Australian one?
More so than here in Australia, although there are elements of right-wing terrorism, and we've seen that in the past here in this country. But the Breivik attack in Oslo was, I think, somewhat of a wake-up call for European countries, and the fact that it happened so recently meant that this particular parliamentary committee couldn't ignore that. I think their recommendation in the report is not as strong as you sort of had suggested early on, Waleed. I think it's, you know, they said we should not focus entirely on Islamist terrorism, and, you know, there are other manifestations of terrorism, which of course have been true for, you know, a good 100 years or more. So that's a fair enough point to make. That, and I think the British authorities have already recognised that, so that's nothing particularly new. Can I just make one very quick point about what David said about the internet and sort of this idea that free and open access of the internet and particularly of extremist material online is both difficult to contain and therefore, you know, we really shouldn't muck around with it too much. I mean, we do regulate the internet and indeed we do find some material to be so abhorrent that we ban it and we take the material down and we... thinking about child pornography stuff here.
Do we do it effectively, though? I mean, you can still get that stuff.
You can, and his point about, you know, you're never going to completely eradicate this sort of material if someone wants to put it online is absolutely correct. But recent report that I've just put out for ASPI suggests that we should now, government should consider actively banning and taking down any website that is attached to a terrorist organisation or that is espousing extremist material. That's a very difficult task. It involves, you know, close cooperation with internet service providers and telecommunications companies. But the fact is that some of this material is so abhorrent, it is being used to radicalise individuals, and indeed it's increasingly being targeted at young people. I mean, this material, a lot of this material is targeted at children in, you know, in that age bracket between 10, 12, 14 and 16. And I think if we find other material on the internet to be abhorrent, then I think a close look at some of the material that's out there on jihadist websites would also fall into that category. And I just think it now that the need to take away this material and its influence on particularly on young people now outweighs the arguments either for sort of internet freedom and openness, or the civil libertarian, you know, the civil libertarian argument about free speech. I just think we've gone past that now, and we should do something about it.
It sounds like a devilishly difficult piece of legislation to design, though, to decide precisely what sort of speech falls over the pale, because you're ultimately making judgments about political conviction here. And
but we already have on the criminal books, hate speech is banned, of course. Mm-hmm. Racial vilification is banned. And when you look at some of this material, particularly the way in which it talks about Jews and and others, I think is sufficiently abhorrent that we should take it down.
That material's not banned in Australia. You just might have to make an apology or a retraction. It's not as though all the newspaper columns that offend those provisions, for example, have to get pulped. So it's a difficult, it's a different sort of exercise, isn't it?
Well, I'm not the lawyer. My understanding was on the criminal code we do have laws about incitement to hatred, and indeed I think it was only 2 years ago that Robin McClelland, as Attorney General, had passed new legislation specifically on that, about individuals who used media to incite hatred amongst others. So I think you find it actually is on the criminal code.
Depends on, there's a range of offences, so I guess it depends on which particular offence you're talking about. Final word to you, Lydia Khalil. I just might wrap it up with your thoughts on whether or not the findings in the UK report are really UK-specific, or whether there's things that we should learn from that report for Australia. I mean, obviously there are some obvious things, like the threat of North Irish violence that perhaps doesn't apply to us. Do you think, generally speaking, this is something that Australians should be paying attention to?
I think there are certain lessons learned from that report. I think that any government that has a high level of diversity and immigration and issues of integration should be paying attention to the report, because there are certain things that came about in that. Certainly issues of radicalization via the internet are not specific to the UK, concern us worldwide, and particularly here in Australia. So, yeah, I think that there are certain things that were brought about that really drove the message home. But I would also say that there really weren't any that many big surprises coming out of that report. I think that if you had taken a look at how the terrorist landscape and the radicalization trajectory has gone for the past few years, looking at that report probably would have just confirmed many of the things that many of the academics and law enforcement and policymakers had been taking a look at.
Mm. I think you're probably right. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your time today. Really good to have you.
Thanks,
on the program.
Thank you. Pleasure.
That's Dr. Carl Ungaro, the Director of the National Security Program at ASPI, Lydia Khalil, who's a former counterterrorism advisor to the New York Police Department and currently the Director of the Risk Capital Group. And previously you heard from David Cake, the Chair of Electronic Frontiers Australia, which is a computer consultancy. 29 minutes past the hour on RN Drive. Coming up, just forget about Jane Fonda. I know that might be difficult for some of you, I know. But if you can, forget about Jane Fonda. We have better ways to work out, and they involve zombies. You can't beat that.